Our scripture reading this morning is from Esther chapter 9, verses 20 through 22. And Mordecai recorded these things and sent letters to all the Jews who are in all the provinces of King Ahasuerus, both near and far, obliging them to keep the 14th day of the month Adar, and also the 15th day of the same, year by year, as the days on which the Jews got relief from their enemies, and as the month that had been turned for them from sorrow into gladness, and from mourning into a holiday, that they should make them days of feastings and gladness, days of sending gifts of food to one another and gifts to the poor.
Sorry. And good morning once more. For local folk, just a word of interest. We were shooting for 300 as our goal today. We didn't quite get there, and that's okay. That means we get to work on it again next year. We ended up at 269, I think, which is still a number to not sneeze at. Although, looking at the amount of filled seats, I was thinking about, had we got to 300, I'm not sure all of you would be in here, but we'd figure it out. This morning, we're going to conclude a series I've been working through, but if you weren't here for the rest of it, that's fine. It's not that kind of series. It's not the kind of series where lesson one explains lesson six. Instead, these have just been kind of loosely affiliated, standalone lessons. And today, my topic is hearing joy. What we've been talking about overall is the concept of how the way God has made us and the common universal human experiences that we all have tell us something about our God, tell us something about ourselves, and we think deep down inside are voices that point us in the right direction if we hear them correctly. Today we'll be hearing joy. And to begin with, we need to start by defining joy and what it means, because I suspect we have probably some less than accurate ideas of what joy is. In the biblical sense of joy, joy is not the same as satisfied, being satisfied, of satisfaction. Satisfaction's a good thing. Contentment, I've got sermons on contentment, and I'm all for it. Contentment is a good thing. Satisfaction is a good thing. But joy is something a little different. Satisfaction is a quiet sensation, the feeling of, this is pretty good. But joy is always extravagant. When you hear about joy, somebody's throwing a party. When you hear about joy, it is something over the top and even unusual. Which is what makes it difficult, because Christians are told over and over again, have joy. Well, how do you have unusual joy every day, right? That seems a little backwards. It seems like it would become usual. That's what Christians are expected to do. Joy is not the same thing as fun. Also like fun. I enjoy fun. I'm all in favor of fun. Please have fun. All in favor of it. But joy is not the same thing. Doing an activity that you enjoy, we even have the word joy in enjoy, right? Doing something that brings you some pleasure that you like doing, that's great. Again, all for it. Glad you got some hobbies. Go do something fun. I think that's wonderful. But it's not what, when the Bible describes joy, it's not just an experience that was fun or what we might call enjoyable. Joy is not the same as excited. And this one, I think, is close to home for churches. Because Christians are told that we're a joyful religion and we have joy, that what we think in our head is we need to translate that into excitement, like a non-stop state of enthusiasm. And so every Sunday morning becomes kind of a pep rally where we're trying to get a little bit more excited and a little louder than the one before that. And again, excitement's great. I like excitement. I hope you're excited. I hope things excite you in life. Maybe we'll say something today that's exciting, but that's not the same thing as joy. It falls into a little bit different category than even that word. And then fourth, joy is not the same thing as happy. Guess what I'm going to say? I like happy. I hope you're happy. I hope today you find happiness. Happiness is good. Not the same thing as joy. Happy, you can hear it in the root word, actually. Happy is derived from the same place as our English word happenstance, or happening, happen. Happiness is when something happens that you like. Something happens. If you walk up to me and hand me a $20 bill, I'm going to say, what makes me happy? Just fun tidbit, you can do that today, and we'll test it. If everybody did that, we'd be all right. My son Calvin is 3 years old, and he has discovered the word happy. Happy is a now satisfactory description of his mood or lack thereof. And so, hey, Calvin, it's time for bed. That not make me happy. Calvin, here's some ice cream. That make me happy. very descriptive. And that's a fine word, but in the Bible, to describe joy as happiness is really to lower the bar a little bit for what the Bible has in mind for this incredible idea of happiness. Happiness is nice, but joy is incredible. And to understand joy, we need a story. So point number zero, before I even get to point number one, is that joy is the kind of sensation and experience in human life that comes with a story. It never stands alone. It always comes about as a result of things that are happening, of events transpiring. And I think the ideal place to learn about joy in the Bible is from the sadly underprivileged and underutilized book of Esther in the Old Testament. Esther is a book that is of incredible value to it. We don't nearly study it as much as we ought to, and I'm not going to today. There's no way I can cover all of the book of Esther in the course of the amount of time I've got remaining, not even remotely possible, so I didn't try. Instead, I'm going to try to summarize the story of Esther and then zoom in on the idea of joy at the end. But let me just quickly, and hopefully accurately, tell you the story of Esther as it unfolds. The story of Esther is set in the period of Old Testament history where the Jews have been having a very rough time. They had been sent off into exile under the Babylonians. Some of them had gone back home under the Persians when they began to rule in about 539 BC. Some of them stayed in Babylon, and some of them actually moved to the city of Susan, which is the capital of Persia at that time, and live in and around the palace and work in and among the Persians. And so this story comes from that period of history, even actually almost 100 years after the events of Babylon and all those things. But they are far removed from their home, is my point. These are Jewish people living in a foreign land under a foreign government, and for them, life is very much up in the air. The way that things play out for you depend on the fickle people who are in charge of you, and they don't understand you at all. I say fickle because the story of Esther starts out with the king who's named in the Bible Ahasuerus, which literally means the Lion King. There's a great Disney reference there, I'm sure. It seems to be the person that historians know as Xerxes I. And he is a prominent Persian king. And somewhere in the course of chapter 1 of Esther, he's throwing himself a party for him and his friends and his nobles and trying to impress them. And he asked his queen, Vashti, to come and kind of put herself on display. The text says, come wearing your crown, and the hint seems to be maybe just your crown. He's trying to show off her beauty, and she says, I'm not going to be put on display in that way, and she refuses. Well, the other nobles kind of elbow the king and say, listen, women's going to get ideas. Right? If the queen can say no to the king, we don't stand a chance with our wives. Right? Well, when you view it that way, it really makes a lot of sense that they would think that way. And as the story plays out, they decide then to remove Vashti from being queen. But now we don't have a queen. So how do you find a wife, fellas? Well, you know, there's the good ways to do it, of looking at character and virtue and all those sorts of things. And then there's the way we actually do it, which is a beauty pageant, where we say, find me the fairest maiden in all the land, and that's what they do. As it turns out, by happy accident, the fairest in all the land was a beautiful young Jewish woman named Esther. And she impresses the king with her beauty, and it turns out there's more to her than just what is skin deep. And so the story that unfolds by her name, the Book of Esther, is the story of her in the place of the queen. She has a relative by the name of Mordecai who lives in the same town, and he is a servant in the house of the king. He works out at the gates of the palace. And Mordecai is a man of character. He actually raised Esther when nobody was there to take care of her, and he's a person with some virtue. So when the nobles come in from Persia and they are expecting people to bow and scrape and treat them like gods on earth, Mordecai says no. He doesn't say it. Actually, he doesn't say a word. He just doesn't kneel. He stands. Because in his mind, I'm Jewish and there's one God and I bow for my God. And so he makes it a point not to bow and treat people who aren't God as if they were. One of those nobles, named Haman the Agagite, which is a fun story on its own, don't have time, Haman the Agagite takes this very personal. He decides that this is a personal insult directed at him. And so his goal is to get rid of Mordecai and to make an example. Do you see the trend here? Vashti doesn't do what she's told. We need to make an example of her, get her out. Mordecai doesn't do what he's told. Got to get rid of him. He's going to be causing trouble. So Haman says, we've got to get rid of this Mordecai fellow. And he conceives of a plot, not just to punish Haman, but everybody like Haman. He wants to eradicate the Jewish people from the empire. Because in his mind, anybody that has a religious view like that, that says there's one God and no room for anybody else, just isn't going to be able to get along with us Persians. They've got to go. And so he plots their genocide. Mordecai goes to Esther. Now, do you see how this weird, twisting story at the begin leads to the scene where Mordecai says, they're about to wipe us out, but look, you're the queen. Nobody even knows it, but the queen of Persia is Jewish. And he says these beautiful words, who knows if thou art come to the kingdom for such a time as this? And I love the way he words it because he expresses a little bit of ignorance. He says, I don't know. He's not claiming that he has, you know, an insight into God's great plan. He even goes on to say, I trust God more than you. He says, if you don't do it, God will bring us salvation from somewhere else. I trust God, but who knows? Maybe the events have transacted in just the way they have and transpired to bring us to this moment where you could save your people in a way no one else possibly could. And so Esther, in considerable courage and risk, goes to the king and butters him up. She throws a banquet. She asks his permission. This is a great thing, right? You want to get what you want, you go to the king and say, do I have your permission to throw you a banquet? Well, yeah, of course you do. That's also the answer I'll give you. If anybody wants to know, if you'd like to throw me a banquet, yes, the answer is yes, you may. And so she goes and she butters him up and she invites Haman over for dinner and they have a couple of banquets. And finally the king says, okay, this is all going somewhere. What are you asking for? And she says, well, there's somebody out to kill me and all my people. Well, who? That guy. And Haman's done for. And so the rest of the book, after several chapters of setup, starting in about chapter 6 through the end of chapter 10, is the story then of the king of Persia doing everything within his power to change the circumstances and allow the Jewish people to defend themselves. He arms them. His own palace guards go and join the ranks of the Jewish people. Because even after Haman's out of the picture, his forces, you know, they can't send an email and say, stop it. So they're still on the march. And so the palace guard goes out and stands next to the Jewish people and defends the Jewish people, and they survive. So that's the story of Esther. The point is that you have kind of a humble beginning, events that don't seem to have anything to do with each other. It's a strange book. This is the only book in the Bible that does not even once mention the name of God. And yet when you read it, you feel like God's all over it. But this thing couldn't have happened any other way. It went from genocide and despair to salvation. And so the book ends by telling the story of what they did because of that. In chapter 8, 16 and 17, it says, the Jews were filled with joy and gladness and were honored everywhere. The Jews rejoiced and had a great celebration and declared a public festival and holiday. Right? When the Bible uses the word joy, this is the kind of story it uses it to describe. This isn't a happy accident. Oh, that was nice. I'm glad you gave me a $20 bill today. Drew the right card in Monopoly and things went well for me. That we think of happiness as a game of chance of some kind and things come our way and that's great. Joy in the Bible is about salvation. Joy in the Bible is about the reversal from despair to hope and to a new reality. This particular story, in fact, was so important. They don't just celebrate it once. They decide, this was so important, we are going to celebrate it from now on. And they institute a new Jewish festival. Recorded in Esther chapter 9, 20-22, Mordecai sent letters to the Jews calling on them to celebrate an annual festival on these 2 days. He told them to celebrate these days with feasting and gladness and by giving gifts of food to each other and presents to the poor. This would commemorate a time when the Jews gained relief from their enemies, when their sorrow was turned into gladness and their mourning into joy. He says, we must never forget how good this happened, how good God treated us this day. We have to remember this joy and celebrate it. And he institutes what becomes, even to this day, the celebration of Purim, which continues today. You can go to Israel and I'm not recommending it, by the way. Purim, just side note, because I love details. Purim is the Jewish equivalent of maybe Mardi Gras. It gets a bit out of hand sometimes. There's a rabbinic expression that they call Purim the day till you can't tell the difference, because the rabbi said everybody drinks till they can't tell the difference between Haman and Mordecai anymore, and they don't remember what the story was about to start with, and they complain a little bit that they get carried away. But the point is, it is a day of kind of like extravagant, outlandish celebration, and people get carried away. And that has continued for thousands of years now. Every year on those 2 days, they say, we need to remember that story and how important it was. Okay, that is the meaning of joy. Joy, number one, is a surprise taste of goodness. True joy in the biblical sense always comes with a surprise. Right? It's always the unexpected. It's always, quite often, the impossible. When something that just couldn't happen, the goodness in a world gone mad, something good happened that we couldn't have anticipated. Who could have ever believed that at the moment on the brink of genocide, the queen would be Jewish in a Persian empire and be able to do something about it? Who could have believed that? A surprise taste of something truly good enters their life. They say that's joy. It's rescue instead of doom. To understand joy in the biblical sense, you have to first get into a pickle, right? Joy isn't everything's going pretty well, and now today it's also going well. Joy is everything is terrible, everything is bad, we are going to die, now we're not. Joy is a surprise rescue. It is a celebration of the impossible happening to bring about salvation. Joy is about reversal and remembrance. When the situation looks like it only could possibly go one way and it completely flips, that's joy. And it's something that we want to remember. Joy is actually rare. In human experience, we have lots of substitutes for joy. I mentioned some of them. Satisfaction, fun, happy, excited. These are all fine things, but we sometimes confuse them with joy. Joy is actually very rare. And so when you have it, you want to remember it, which is what they do. Every year, we should remember that day we experienced actual joy and the events that led up to it. I want you to turn now to your New Testament as we kind of bring this to our point. You say, finally, John chapter 16 is the New Testament discussion of joy that I think is probably most helpful in understanding what we can learn from the experience of joy and our fascination with it. John chapter 16 is another dark moment in the Bible. This is the moment when Jesus is sitting down with his disciples in a very private, candid conversation. He is hours, maybe minutes away from the trials and ultimately the crucifixion. He has been in Jerusalem for a week. The people that don't like him now really don't like him. And his disciples know that something bad is about to happen. And worse yet, Jesus isn't even denying it. Right? The disciples feel like something bad's about to happen. And Jesus isn't saying, oh no, I'll get it taken care of. Don't worry about it. He's saying, no, you're right, I'm going to die. To say they are troubled is an understatement. And so chapters 14, 15, and 16 in John is Jesus encouraging them, not by avoiding reality, not by telling them it's not as bad as you think, by saying, oh no, it's every bit as bad as you think, but let me tell you what else. So John chapter 16, read with me verses 16 through 20. He says, a little while, and you will see me no longer, and again a little while, and you will see me. Don't you love it when Jesus says something that's really easy to understand? That one's a little bit of a cryptic little riddle there. Well, you'll see me, and then you won't see me, and it'll be a little while, and then it'll be... Well, so some of his disciples said to one another, what is this that he says to us? A little while, and you will not see me. Again, a little while, and you will see me. And because I'm going to my Father... So they were saying, what does he mean by a little while? And what do you... We do not know what he is talking about. Right? They're already troubled. They're already concerned. The handwriting's on the wall. They know what's going to happen next. And they're looking for encouragement, and he's talking riddles. He's not saying it's going to be okay. He says, no, no, it's going to be bad. And the only hint he gives of hope is couched in a difficult saying. So they're very upset at this point, to the point that they're muttering, Jesus is talking to them, and they're muttering and kind of at the other end of the table, having a little discussion amongst themselves. What are we supposed to do with that one? And so he continues in verse 19. Jesus knew that they wanted to ask him. So he said to them, "Is this what you are asking yourselves? What I meant by saying, 'A little while and you will not see me, and again a little while and you will see me'? Truly, truly, I say to you, you will weep and lament, but the world will rejoice." Stop there. I know it's the middle of a sentence, but middle of a verse, but stop there. What does he say? He says, first of all, he is aware of the anxiety they have toward this situation. He is not immune to it himself. We see him in Gethsemane with the same kind of emotions praying to his God. He is deeply troubled himself, and he understands. The thing he does, though, is he doesn't sugarcoat anyway, any part of it. He says, let me tell you what's going on. Yes, bad things are about to happen. You will mourn. And it's what's worse, what's the only thing worse than mourning? When your enemies are dancing a happy dance next to you. Not only will you mourn, but the people who think they are your adversaries will be celebrating. And that is salt in an open wound. That is going to be hard to bear. But what he is acknowledging here is the imperfect joy which the world will come to know. I mean, even without the rest of this sermon, we can kind of get the point. Joy over somebody's death can't be the right kind of joy. Joy over an innocent man's crucifixion can't be the right kind of joy. And so he says, yes, you're going to mourn. Yes, there are other people who will rejoice. But that's not the end of the story. Truly, truly, I say to you, you will weep and lament, but the world will rejoice. You will be sorrowful, but your joy, or your sorrow, will turn into joy. Jesus says, this is my promise. Yes, it is bad. Yes, it's going to get worse. It will change. The promise is that there will be a reversal of consequences, that it will change. If you will experience and endure with patience the sorrow and the grief, something will happen. The rescue, the surprise, the reversal, where the only word left to describe that is joy. Verse 21 to 22, he continues to explain this. He uses a little metaphor. He says, when a woman is giving birth, she has sorrow because her hour has come. But when she has delivered the baby, she no longer remembers the anguish for joy that a human being has been born into the world. So also you have sorrow now. But I will see you again, and your hearts will rejoice, and no one will take your joy from you. In that day, you will ask nothing of me. What's he talking about? He tells a story of a woman giving birth and explains it. And how does she explain it? She says, what does a mother think about during the delivery? If you have the misfortune of being in the room, you know exactly what it is. It is the regret of an entire life and of ever having met me, right? That you did this thing to me. This is all your fault. And no, you know, it's not a pleasant experience, right? Or so I'm told. Often, right? That is not a fun experience. But then what do we remember at birthday parties? I've been to a lot of birthday parties. I've never been once where the mother cutting the cake says, let me tell you what I was doing this time a couple of years ago, you know, and tells the story of how miserable it is. You look at your beautiful little child and you say, we're so glad to have you. And it actually happens instantaneously. In that room, this bizarre transformation takes place from agony and despair, the worst thing I have ever felt, to, oh, the little baby. And it happens just that fast. And Jesus says that is the definition of joy. Imperfect joy strives to remember. We're always trying to catch that joy we lost. We remember feeling good once. I'd like to have that back. Perfect joy forgets. Perfect joy is able to look past everything bad that happened and only see the best part of it and celebrate it. Imperfect joy can be taken. I can rob, if your joy is based on happenstance, if your joy is based on possessions, if your joy is based on the circumstances of life, I can change those circumstances and steal your joy. It is no longer yours. But if it's the kind of joy the Bible describes, it can't be taken. That reversal is from God and has simply taken place. It is now a fact of the universe. That's why the people celebrated at the crucifixion, because they thought this was a fact. Here was a man who was causing us trouble. That man is dead. The end of the story. And God said, it's not the end. And he reversed it so completely and so permanently that death itself has been defeated by the story of Jesus Christ. Perfect joy remains. So I would encourage you this morning to listen to joy. Listen to what that experience is telling you. Every time we experience joy only to lose it, we are reminded to seek joy that cannot be lost. There's a reason we call the gospel the gospel. It means good news. It is the best possible reversal. It is exactly what we crave and desire, and it can never be taken away. That's why we cherish it so very much. If you would have that joy in your life, and if you're tired of the fleeting, passing, temporary joy that you cling to and fight to hold only to lose, find joy somewhere that cannot be taken away. And that's exactly how Jesus ends this passage. In verse 24, he says, ask, and you will receive, that your joy may be full. Jesus wants to give you that joy. Crazier still, Jesus enjoys giving you that joy. Jesus suffered everything he experienced so that you could have a permanent state of reversal in your life, that all wrongs could be made right. And he makes that offer to you today. He has paid the debt on the cross. And in faith and in turning to him in obedience, we begin a life that is this continued presence of unstealable joy. If there's anything we can do to help you experience that, we're going to stand and sing a word of song. Won't you come?